The first case on the docket is 13-21-00241-CV, Azteca International Corporation, DBA Azteca America Stations Group, LLC, Northern Star McKellen License LLC, TB Azteca SAB de CV, Publimax SA de CV, and Patricia Chapoy versus Gloria de Los Angeles Trevino Ruiz, Angel Gabriel de Jesus Trevino, and Armando Ismael Gomez Martinez.
May it please the court. Again, I'm Paul Wattler, counsel for the appellants, TV Azteca, and the Azteca parties, as we refer to them. In my argument today, I will show that it was error for the trial court to deny the motion for final summary judgment and the motion to dismiss that was filed by the Azteca parties. The live pleading in this case, which is the sixth amended petition, purports to state claims on 31 distinct allegedly defamatory statements by three different plaintiffs, or in favor of three different plaintiffs. It's a complex record, a lot of history to this case. If I can here at the outset, just try to cut through some of this fog. Simply, 28 out of the 31 statements, allegedly defamatory statements, are barred by limitations, by the one-year statute of limitations applicable in a libel case. 28 out of 31, as to plaintiffs Trevi and Gomez. The other three are subject to dismissal, as you can see from our chart here, on other grounds that can be decided on summary judgment or motion to dismiss. These are by and large legal questions or legal doctrines that arise in defamation cases, such as the notion that a statement has to be of and concerning the plaintiff. Here we have a multitude of statements, many of which, not all of which, directly refer and are about Gloria Trevi, virtually none of which are about her husband or her now adult son, who was a minor son.
Counsel, let me interrupt you there. Can you summarize which of Gabriel's claims you're seeking to dismiss? That's the child. Or now adult child.
Gabriel, yes. Well, we seek dismissal. Well, first off, in his case, there's 31 claims pleaded. Seven of them was previously dismissed by the 2020 opinion by this court, yet they were reasserted on remand in the Sixth Amendment petition. So seven of them are out, essentially on limitations or law of the case.
But don't we have an agreement on that, Counselor? I thought that in the petition there's a footnote that says they're just re-urging them because out of abundance of caution, not that they understand the ruling of the court.
They were pleaded. It's unclear to me whether they're, everything that I've seen in the briefing so far is that they intend to go forward, that they are seeking to bring those claims to trial as well. So there's seven that are clearly out on limitation, but only seven as to Gabrielle, the son. So that leaves 24 claims that are not subject to dismissal from the prior opinion on limitations. 22 out of 24, it's our contention, are not of and concerning Gabrielle. That leaves two that certainly do refer to him. But we say that they are non-defamatory because they use a term commenting on the fact that he was born out of wedlock. And so we have a couple bases there as a matter of law that those two should be dismissed.
What statements are you saying those are specifically?
Those would be statements 30 and 31 that do directly reference Ms. Trevi's son. There's a chart at the back of our appellate's brief. I think it's the first tab back there. You can see the statements summarized.
And taking
there,
like number, I guess 30 as an example, it's your contention that there's nobody in the world that would hear the word bastard with regard to a child and think that that's defamatory?
Well, that may have been ancient law. There's old cases that would say that that's actionable. There's more modern cases, which we brought forward in our brief, that said that is just, that's the old way of thinking.
But aren't there modern day cases that say if anybody in the world heard it and it upset or was bad to anybody, then it's a viable cause of action?
Yeah, a defamation claim certainly requires a publication, someone to have heard it, to read it. They certainly do allege that, and it's our position, a couple of things. One is, you know, the definition of the term is a child born out of wedlock. That is how the term is used in these two statements, 30 and 31. So, of course, truth is a defense to a allegedly defamatory statement. So here, it's absolutely true. It's not disputed even by the plaintiffs in any way in this case that now Mr. Gabriel was born out of wedlock. Our point is that in the old days, people might have held someone like that in disrepute, but in modern thinking, modern society, that casts no aspersion. That child born out of wedlock has the same rights, the same standing, due to the same respect as any child that might have been born out of a wedded relationship. So that's why it's not.
Let me interrupt you. Don't you think that maybe the term even now is not necessarily referencing a child born out of wedlock, but more just as an offensive term?
It is often used that way, particularly on social media, and these, yes, these particular statements were tweets on Twitter, often used that way. But in this context and in this reference, it is referring to how the child was conceived. So it is definitely using the term in the sense of a child born out of wedlock. So number one, it's a true statement of fact that he was born out of wedlock, undisputed. Really, the inquiry should end there. If the term is offensive, that doesn't make it actionable. It may be a crude term, it may be a poor choice of words, but again, something in a tweet, we see these sort of things all the time on social media. It doesn't mean that they're actionable. Texas law is very clear that offensive or hurtful words in and of themselves are not actionable in defamation, nor should they be, because in the age of social media, courts would be flooded with these kinds of claims. So
isn't it the standard, though, that if some viewers were to see that and be offended, then it becomes a question of fact for a jury?
No, not necessarily. The court in the first instance must find that it's reasonably capable of a defamatory meaning. So it can be decided in the first instance, and we think it should be here. It's not, does it on its face state a false statement of fact that tends to injure the reputation? That's the test in the mind of an ordinary viewer here. So first off, there's no false statement of fact with the use of that term. It is a true statement, so it's not actionable in that sense. And an ordinary viewer is a person of ordinary intelligence. They're also charged with society mores that says a person born out of wedlock is not someone held up to disrepute. So it's just not actionable in modern usage. So we have, if I can, 28 statements as to Trevi and Gomez, her husband, barred by limitations. And that's just a simple math problem, if you will, here. The limitations issue, you look at when the date of publication of the statement, the date that it was pleaded, and if it was pleaded more than 1 year after publication, and this is the holding from the 2020 opinion in this case, if it was pleaded more than 1 year after publication, it's simply barred by limitations. That's the case with 28 of these statements. So three of these statements as to Trevi and Gomez, let's talk about them, because they're subject to dismissal on other grounds and other bases. As to Gomez, the husband, they're subject to dismissal on the oven concerning prong of this here. But as to Ms. Trevi, we have statement 22. What is statement 22? Statement 22 is a commentary, if you will, by a news anchor for a TV entertainment program by TV Azteca. And he's commenting on this other program on another network. It's the Mexican version of The Voice, La Voz. And he's commenting about the persons, and Ms. Trevi was one of the 20 or so judges of that show. And he doesn't ever refer to Ms. Trevi by name, but what he says is, well, it's really terrible that Televisa has chosen to use judges, some of whom are criminals, and even one who has been accused of murder. That's statement 22.
But so, are there any other judges on that show that have been accused of murder?
Well, first off, I would point out that Gloria Trevi was never charged with murder. That's not part of her criminal case.
I didn't use
case.
The word charge, counsel. I just said accused.
There's no evidence in the record of any of her or anyone else being accused of murder. So a person of ordinary intelligence is a person that, there's no evidence that such a person would associate that statement with Gloria Trevi. It's their burden to bring forward that sort of evidence. They didn't bring forward any evidence that any ordinary listener or viewer would have understood that term as referring to Ms. Trevi, as opposed to any of the other 20 judges. So what the group libel doctrine says is that when you have a statement that refers to a group of people, and the statement could be applicable to any one of them, any one of these judges might have been a person accused of murder, and it doesn't single out the one, doesn't tell you who the one is among that group on its face, which is what we have here, that statement is not of and concerning, in this case, Ms. Trevi, so it's barred by that doctrine.
What about the fact that, you know, she is a very, very high public figure, and that, you know, she was considered the Mexican Madonna for quite some time, and as such, people, most of her audience and people that read this knew exactly who it was referring to. I don't know that much about this type of music, but I knew exactly who it was referring to.
Yeah.
So
there's no doubt that she's a public figure and that she's very well known. There is no proof that the ordinary listener or viewer would necessarily associate her with an accusation of murder.
But doesn't
that's the element
case
that's
law
lacking.
Say it's indirect or direct?
Yes.
Ties. So wouldn't this be an indirect?
The ordinary viewer has to hear and understand that statement, and there's no evidence of that the plaintiff should have brought forward, that the ordinary viewer would have heard and understood that in that way. Simply a lack of evidence in this record. So that takes care of statement 22. Then let me also turn to statements 23 and 24, which are the other two of the three that are not barred by limitations. Statements 23 and 24 are actually excerpted from an article that was posted online, a website, by a website called Terra.com. And that article, it talks about that there was a controversy at that time raging on Twitter about Gloria Trevi and about her criminal case. Her criminal case when she was actually indicted and arrested on charges related to sexual trafficking of young girls, underage girls. And it talks about the fact that those accusations were made against her, that she was arrested, that she was in prison, and importantly, because the plaintiffs leave this out, that that particular charge against her was dismissed. Now, why is it important that this is part of a larger article that we put before the trial court? It's part of the record in this case. Because longstanding Texas defamation law says you have to construe an allegedly defamatory statement in context. You can't just cherry pick particular sentences and leave out other things that give a different context. So the way they pleaded it, it takes it out of context. What is the context that they've left out that's so important? They left out that the entire article includes the reference that the charges were dismissed against her and she was released from prison. So that puts it in the category of these were allegations that were made against her, but the allegations, the criminal charges, if you will, were dismissed against her. That brings it under what we have in Texas, and this is a fairly recent statute from 2015, what's referred to often as the third-party allegation rule. And that statute simply says that when a member of the news media provides an accurate report on a matter of public concern, a comment made by a third party, and it accurately states that, and the comment concerns a matter of public concern, then if a libel case arises out of that, that media defendant has the right or the defense of substantial truth. All those elements are here in this particular two statements, 23 and 24.
And those elements come from the KMBT case, correct?
And there's a related privilege. They sort of overlap, but your court's exactly correct, Your Honor. That's the what's called the fair report privilege, the privilege to give a fair and accurate account of an official proceeding. It's worth noting, because this is also part of what plaintiffs left out in their pleadings. Not only does that the left out port, the omitted portion, say that the charges was dismissed, but they said that it was in a criminal case, and they specified the court, the seventh court in the state of Chihuahua, and that the court had dismissed these charges. That makes it an accurate report. Both sides, the plaintiffs themselves, described the case exactly the way statements 23 and 24 were viewed in the context of the entire article. What happened in that case? There's no dispute that that's an accurate account of this official proceeding. What's the official proceeding that's mentioned in this article? The actual proceeding is mentioned in this article. And that is the criminal case in the state of Chihuahua against Ms. Trevi some years ago.
I have a question, and I'm going to I'll give you a little bit of time to answer, because I'm going to use your time.
Sure.
When I read that KMT case, I had a question about, and I think it's something that's important here, that doctrine was created because of a matter of public concern, meaning if you hear that somebody got shot outside and you're a reporter and you don't have it verified, it's a public concern that you can get on the radio and go, hey, I just heard somebody was shot,
right,
and without being held liable. But in this situation, I mean, we have something that happened years ago. The proceeding is so attenuated. Do you think that makes any difference here?
No, I don't think so, because the underlying issue is certainly of continuing public concern, and that
what is that issue?
Alleged sex trafficking of underage girls and criminal prosecutions relating to that. And was Ms. Trevi... It's a current controversy because, as the article points out, there's a controversy on Twitter. Is Ms. Trevi a feminist? And she claims she was a victim and that she was innocent in all this. Or was she, in fact, involved in all this? So it's a matter of ongoing concern that she was previously charged with that, and there's still controversy about it. And the controversy is about a case involving sex trafficking. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. If this court had jurisdiction, I would be pleased to talk to the court about how extraordinarily meritorious these defamation claims are. And the way I would do it is by focusing on claims we've already heard about. The claim by Ms. Trevi of Statement 24 and Gabriel's claims about the Bastardo statements. Those statements alone have no limitations problems and are standing alone perfectly sufficient to justify a trial, a very meaningful verdict, and will withstand analysis on appeal. I would like very much to spend all of my time on that today, but I can't because this court lacks appellate jurisdiction. The court needs to begin there and look very closely at this question, not just because it decides this case, but also because the question of jurisdiction here includes embedded issues that are very serious significance to other cases that are going to come up on this court's docket. This has only been brought up for the first time on the appellant side in the reply brief, and so I want to make sure that we have a clear opportunity to leave no stone unturned about why the court cannot act on the merits in this case, though we wish eventually we will. These arguments and this chart that you see will be reached at some point, probably at the charge conference, we think is the more appropriate time, or maybe later in this case, but not now because of the procedural posture. And that's where I want to turn. The immediate question presented comes from Chapter 51, Civil Practice and Remedies Code. The question is, have they appealed from an order that, quote, denies one of the listed motions? And there is no order denying those motions here. I want to make a very important legal point that there is a critical difference between an order that denies the motions and an order that defers a ruling on the motions, or an order that refuses to rule. The text of this statute, Chapter 51, requires an order that denies. And the reason we know that matters is because of the mandamus precedent. The whole reason that mandamus exists to cover refusals to rule and deferrals is because there is no appellate jurisdiction. Those differences are critical. The appellants here have only invoked appellate jurisdiction. That is their only route into the court.
Counsel, but hasn't the TCPA a motion been overruled by operation of law? I mean, the statute is very clear. Judge has 90 days. If he doesn't rule, you know, basically it's overruled by an operation of law. I understand your position, and you're saying that because he did rule, in other words, he postponed, he didn't, that was his ruling. I guess that's your position that you're taking here today?
Not quite, Your Honor. Our position is that the district court in this case suspended that ruling requirement, the requirement that it rule within that time period, and it did so expressly. You can see it in the order. The district court knew what it was doing. When it said, I'm going to defer a ruling, you'll see this in the clerk's record at page 1257. He says that the court is exercising an authority to do this by virtue of its inherent authority and the Supreme Court's emergency COVID orders.
That's Counselor, I mean, seriously, looking at that order, it says it's going to defer ruling until the close of evidence. That just turns summary judgment law on its stomach. I mean, I just don't see how you can make that argument, honestly.
Your Honor, the merits of the question are one thing. So as I understand it, the appellants make two arguments. Number one, they say that the trial court here didn't actually defer the ruling by using this authority. And number two, they say that he couldn't. And I understand your argument to go to the second one, but let me make sure we separate them clearly.
Gotcha.
We see here first a clear invocation of that authority, and then it's quite clear that that's the only thing the court was doing. It knew it was extending the deadline, and it said push it to the end of trial. The question is, can the court do that? Can it suspend the TCPA deadline? And the answer is yes. There are only two authorities on point. We've given them to the court. One of them is the Kim versus Ramos case, and one of them is the CBS case. Those are the authorities that we've supplied already. CBS is exactly this case, where a district court decides, I'm going to push the deadline and not rule on a TCPA motion. If the court's concern were true, CBS couldn't have held what it did. The Supreme Court, when it issued these orders that let district courts change any deadline in any case, knew exactly what it was doing.
But counsel, the whole purpose, in my estimation, of the rules that came out as a result of COVID was to make sure somebody was able to have their day in court. That if the court could not hear a case or have a hearing on an issue, that those deadlines would be expanded. But in this case, you all did have your day in court. The judge had the opportunity to consider it, and then he chose not to. And I read the order, and I know exactly what the court did. I mean, the whole purpose of summary judgment and the whole purpose, my understanding of something like TCPA, is to avoid having to go to trial, for judicial economy, and also to streamline cases and to get rid of issues that don't have to go to jury trial. But in this case, the judge is sort of taking a, let me see what happens at trial and then I'll decide. Doesn't that seem rather like, you know, Judge Longoria just said, turning all that, you know, over? I mean, just on its stomach, you know.
Your Honor, we have two reasons that concern shouldn't sway the case here. Number one is that if we look at the text of the Supreme Court's order, the one that lets the district courts change these rules, it says that there is only one kind of concern that can stop a trial court from changing these rules, and that's a constitutional concern, some sort of due process-related right that is at the core of the administration of justice. It did not say that these decisions are subject to abuse of discretion review. It did not say that these rule tweaks are subject to review for whether it advances the purposes of the TCPA or a statute. The only concerns that district courts have to honor when they move these deadlines are the constitutional concerns. That's the textual answer I have. But there is also a good practical reason here. We know that because of the pandemic, getting any case to trial is more difficult than it ever was. This case is extraordinarily old, and the need for justice is extraordinarily strong. And the one concern you have, it's articulated on the record, this is 1RR6, is the judge says this is an extraordinarily old case, and the judge determines the best way to dispose of this is push it to trial and have the determinations made then. Now, I will grant the point that is a debatable proposition, and the legislature probably has a difficult debate about when TCPA is more important than the right to a trial. But remember that the trial court's authority to change these deadlines is based in statute. There's a statute that says in the event of an emergency, the legislature gives the Supreme Court the authority to make rules, and the Supreme Court here in turn gave this court the broadest possible authority. There is no tying requirement that says the district court has to make findings or conclusions about why tweaking the rules is justified. There's no linkage requirement. None of that exists in this rule. The Kim versus Ramos case is really good on this point. We've read every emergency order that the court has ever issued. They came out not just in this pandemic, but in prior situations like hurricanes. And so the Supreme Court is essentially a lawmaking body in this essence. And sometimes they say that district courts can change the rules only if there's a difficulty posed by the hurricane or the weather or something, but not in this case. The district court here had its broadest authority, and it was exercised here. And more importantly, the appellants didn't challenge that. Right? That's the substance of the decision. They don't even acknowledge that it happened here. I think for this court's jurisdictional analysis, all you have to determine is that there is no order denying. If they want to come back later in another proceeding and litigate this question of whether the rule suspension was correct, whether the refusal to rule really prejudices them, whether this has a sort of benefit and burden balancing the mandamus, as they can do that later, but not in this particular proceeding. I do want to spend some time on the substance so that the court understands how strong those are. So let me just track what I said I think are the two key claims that can demonstrate the strength of the case overall. Let's start with Ms. Trevi's claim on Statement 24. So Statement 24 is one of the statements that has no limitations arguments whatsoever. so we don't have to talk at all about limitations, and there are precious few other arguments. You can see here on the chart that they have the third-party allegation rule and the fair reporting privilege. And what their defense amounts to is the notion that in Statement 24, all that they were doing is reconveying what others had said. But that is just not true. They are not just reconveying what others said. They are, in fact, adopting the statements as their own and vouching for the truth. Look at the first sentence. They don't say that someone else has alleged or that someone has reported. They say, this is how a network of young girls got started, in which there were rapes, pregnancies, forced abortions, and so forth. That isn't reporting anything. That is they, the speaker, asserting the statement. And there's no defense to this other than to say that maybe it didn't directly refer to her, but we have the second sentence right there, Gloria's name. So this is a clear case where their only defenses are the third-party allegation rule and the fair reporting privilege, and neither of those applies. Remember in the D Magazine case is the one that talks about the fair reporting privilege. And what it says is that you can use that privilege, but only if you make sure that you don't omit facts, and only if you make sure that you don't juxtapose facts. And I think the court has a very serious concern here, and a good concern, that in the heat of a moment, when there's an actual emergency going on, we look at statements in that context. If there's an actual emergency situation going on the corner, and the TV reporter is there on the day, then when we say, did they omit facts? Did they juxtapose facts? You can analyze that context. Here, there is no emergency. There is no urgency. There was full time for contemplation, and still they omitted facts, they juxtaposed facts, and they told flat out lies. The other answer you have from them is that these statements are so outrageous, no one would believe them. But that doesn't make them less liable, that makes them more liable. That's the whole point. They are conveying as true factual insults that injure our clients tremendously. And their defense is to say it was so bad no one believed them just turns the doctrine on its head. So that's the argument as to Statement 24 for Ms. Trevi. Now let's talk about Gabriel's claims in Statements 25 through 31, and in particular, the Bastardo claims. Here too, there is no limitations argument whatsoever. The only argument they say is that this doesn't constitute defamation because they're only reporting the mere fact of being born out of wedlock. But that's not all that the statement says. We can say this in multiple ways. Number one, the statement asserts more than just the bastard term. You can see Statement 30 has the word sired, right? That he was sired. Now, this may sound ridiculous in some contexts, but here it matters because there are actual facts about how this child came into the world that involve horses and equine reproduction. And so for them to assert that he was sired is indeed a defamatory statement. You can also see in Statement 31, they say that he was spawned. This is not just the bastard assertion. This is not the dictionary style recitation that you heard from my friend. That is not what is in those statements. More importantly, we know that even the term bastard itself connotes more than just the raw facts you heard about before. That is both proven in the record. We have evidence of that term's disputed meaning. That's a clerk's record, pages 1109 and 1110. And we also have the district court in this case taking judicial notice that that term has more than one meaning and is subject to different constructions by different reasonable listeners. None of that is answered by the other side. And so this feeds into the rules that the court has already identified. Two of them are clear. Number one, if these statements are ambiguous in any respect, it could be understood in one of two ways. They go to trial, and the jury determines their status as defamatory. Another rule that I want to put out there, this is in the briefs, this comes from the Turner case, is that when we look at these statements, courts are supposed to, quote, refrain from a hair-splitting analysis of what is said to find an innocent meaning. And I think what you've heard from the other side is exactly that, a hair-splitting analysis that's trying to find an innocent meaning. These statements, as to Mr. Gabriel, and particularly 30 and 31, are clear instances that refer directly to him. They state false facts, right, that indeed meet the test to a T. They expose him to public ridicule. That's the test for defamation, and it's met in this case.
Counsel, let's clean something up. We have previously ruled, this court has ruled, on seven of the alleged defamatory statements that we found that they were barred by statute of limitations. How do you get around our previous holding? Are you trying to get around our previous holding?
We're not, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I may, I'd like to circle back to one jurisdictional point that I think is critical. One of the jurisdictional arguments you have is that the trial court here impliedly denied these motions, and that's incorrect. You have a series of cases that the defendants cite on page 12, and they cite some cases to say that if a trial court defers a ruling, that's the same as actually denying the motion, but that's not the case. Those cases don't apply here because those cases aren't about the jurisdictional question. The jurisdictional question cares about, is there a denial versus a deferral? That matters very much to Chapter 51, the jurisdictional statute. But all the cases that they've cited you are about preservation under Trap 33.1. And the preservation rules don't care about the difference between a denial and a deferral. You can look at the text of Trap 33. It says you have to get a ruling or a refusal to rule.
But counsel, are there any cases where we have a statute like the TCPA that has a specific finding that if the judge doesn't rule, you basically lose by operation of law? Or are there any cases that say that if the judge has ruled to defer, that essentially tolls the time period, or that the court has the authority to do that when the statute is very clear about it has to rule within a certain period of time?
I think I see two cases that I can give you, so let me give you two. First of all, there are cases that hold that when a trial court defers a ruling on a motion like this, it's not denying it, right? That's different. And that case is the Grant case that we've cited you. So that's one of the motions, a motion for summary judgment based on First Amendment grounds. That is all the arguments you hear from the other side today, where they say, if you don't actually deny this, if you just defer it, it's as though you denied it. And the court in Grant rejects that. It says, no, a deferral is not a denial, and so your only solution here is mandamus. There's a second authority from this court that we've also given. That's the In re McAllen Hospital's decision, which gives you the similar ruling in a motion to dismiss context.
Those are the cases cited in your letter brief.
Yes, Your Honor. So those go to the question of what the denial versus deferral. And then I want to reemphasize the CBS case. We've given the court the CBS case, and that's the case holding that for this exact kind of motion, a TCPA motion to dismiss, that a district court has the authority to defer the ruling. And the reason it has that authority is because of the Supreme Court's emergency orders. I think there's no answer to the CBS case. There's also no answer to the Kim versus Ramos case. We've supplied the court with those decisions. I don't understand my friends on the other side to have any answer to those decisions. We've looked for any case that says a court can't extend the deadlines like this.
Have you found any cases that says a court can extend a deadline to a specific time? I think, you know, if the court had said in the order, we're going to defer ruling till later, but the order specifically says we're going to defer ruling until after the close of evidence, and to me therein lies the problem. Do you have anything that is a scenario like that that we can look at?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the CBS case I've given you is that scenario, because in CBS there wasn't even a statement of when the ruling was going to be. It was indefinite. The parties had no idea.
Can you give me the cite to the CBS case?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in the letter we filed yesterday, but I'll give it to you.
Also?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Every case I've given you is in the letter that we filed yesterday or our
briefs. Here it is. I found it.
Okay.
Oh, I thought you were saying CBS and it's CBS.
Sorry,
counsel. Sorry.
quite different there, Your Honor.
Sorry.
Another thing I'll say is that remember when the defendants here filed their interlocutory appeal, they divested the district court of jurisdiction to do anything else. We would like very much to go to trial immediately. Let's go. But they have stopped the trial court from doing anything else in the case, like setting a trial immediately, putting these motions to tee up, and so we don't know what the trial court would do. This is all the more reason to say, dismiss the appeal, go back down. If they want to demand that the trial court make a ruling and actually tell us what its reasons are, that will facilitate this court's review of the merits much better and give us a clear picture of the case. This is why courts don't take interlocutory appeals when the court hasn't actually ruled yet, because it makes this court's job all the harder to do all of these tasks. The last thing I have is one supplement. There was a factual point about whether anybody had ever accused our client of murder in the record, and that no one could believe that she was implicated in murder. But you can see these exact statements in what we're suing about, statement 19 and statement 21. are where the defendants say that she is involved in the murders. And so for them to say no reasonable listener could believe this contradicts what's coming out of their own mouths.
19 and which one, I'm sorry, Counselor?
21, Your Honor. 21. Unless the court has further questions, we'll yield the balance of our time. Thank you.
May it please the court. Yes, this is, the case has been going on for a long time, and it does need resolution. There are important rights at issue. I would like to start by reminding the court, one of those very important rights is the right of freedom of the press, the right of the news media to report and to comment on criminal proceedings, to comment on things like allegations of sexual trafficking of minor girls. So when you rule in this case, you're vindicating those rights as well. And if you listen to counsel for the plaintiff's argument, the appellees here, appears that we're frustrating a trial. There's no trial setting in this case. After this case was remanded in 2020, there was no request for a trial setting, either before or after we filed our motion to dismiss, which is in motion for summary judgment, which is now on appeal. So, does the court have appellate jurisdiction? Let me just address that. Yes, it does. And I'll restate our position so it's clear. Both the 51.014A6, which concerns media motions for summary judgment in media libel cases, and I think it's A12, which governs interlocutory appeals of the denial of a motion to dismiss, do say that an order that denies such a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss is subject to interlocutory review. We have that here because, as Justice Longoria pointed out, it is clear that the essence of this order is to force us to proceed to trial. We brought forward in our brief cases that have held that when a court hears a summary judgment and enters an order that says we're now going to trial, that is an implied denial of the motion for summary judgment. That's existing Texas case law.
And is that how you distinguish the CBS case and the Ramos case?
That is one of the ways. I would also point out the CBS case is very, very distinguishable here because that's a case that, that concerns emergency power granted by the Texas Supreme Court under these COVID orders. And what's important to notice, you would notice from counsel's earlier remarks, is in that case, and I think Justice Longoria picked up on this, the judge expressly continued the hearing to a date certain because of the COVID authority that was vested in the court. This order does not do that. It does not continue the hearing to any specific date, for one thing, and it doesn't say that it's exercising any authority to continue deadlines or continue hearings out of the COVID order. It does refer to, in a footnote, cryptically, that it's making this order in under its inherent authority and the COVID rules, but it doesn't say it's exercising. So what we have here is a debate of, might a court have authority to extend deadlines? CBS answers that question and says, yes, if the court actually exercised that authority, we recognize that it does. But here we don't have an order that on its face can reasonably be read as exercising that authority, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't say because of COVID conditions or because of my authority under the COVID rules, I'm extending any deadlines here or continuing a hearing.
And I guess that's why you chose not to file a mandamus, because your position is that it was effectively denied.
Exactly. That's exactly our position, Your Honor. And as also, I think there's some mischaracterization of the case law here. In their letter brief, they cite these two cases that they filed yesterday, the McAllen Hospitals case and the Grant versus Wood case. And they say that these are examples of a court deferring ruling and not denying ruling. But in fact, if you read those cases, in fact, just read the excerpts that they include in their letter ruling, letter brief, those are cases of refusal to rule, a refusal to rule. Why is that important? Where a judge in the Grant versus Wood case, for instance, the trial judge on the record said that she was refusing to rule because I know you, media defendant, have a right of interlocutory appeal and we're going to go to trial and I'm just not going to rule. a refusal to rule. Here, we don't have a refusal to rule. So the refusal to rule cases don't even apply. We have a ruling here drafted by counsel for the plaintiff and put before Judge Flores that he didn't say I'm refusing to rule. He said I'm deferring the ruling. Why is that distinction important here? Because we have a written order. McAllen Hospitals and Grant versus Wood, there were no written orders. Here we have a written order that was signed by the court. Again, it doesn't say I'm refusing to rule. It says I'm deferring ruling. That constitutes an implied denial when fairly read. That's our position of how this court has appellate jurisdiction.
Just one question. Was there anything in the record as to the reasoning behind the court's ruling?
No, there was not. There was not. It basically simply says the court heard these motions. The court believes that the case should proceed to trial. The court will take up these motions at the close of evidence at trial. That's all it says. And then in a footnote says, oh, I have the authority to do this under inherent authority and the COVID rules. It doesn't say it's doing it because of the COVID situation, or I'm granting a continuance because of COVID considerations or anything of that sort. Makes it a very different case.
The case will be under submission.